Hi, this is Bill Meyer. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. You can hear the show every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 noon Central, and there are many more podcasts for this and all of our other faith radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
He's a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
Well, do our churches need to slow down in 2014? Maybe so. We're going to be talking to one of the co-authors of the book, Slow Church, Cultivating Community in the Patient Way of Jesus, in just a few minutes here on Faith Radio. And he's going to probably challenge some of the notions that we have about church growth strategies and how church is done. And if you are involved in church leadership in any way, shape, or form, if you're a pastor, associate pastor, if you're on a committee, or an elder deacon at your church, or just maybe lead a Sunday school class, or are interested in how your church can best function and really best follow in the way of Jesus, you will be fascinated by what this gentleman has to say. So, and we're also going to talk about what he's doing in his own church to actually make this happen. That's coming up in just a few minutes here on the Faith Radio Network. We appreciate you making us part of your weekend, wherever you might be today. And I found an interesting story this week about Facebook. If you are a Facebook user, this, well, I think you should know this. Could you be addicted to Facebook? We've all heard about alcohol addiction and gambling addiction, sex addiction, but what about Facebook addiction? Some new research done by the University of Chicago, and it found that Facebook, over time, can actually be more addictive than cigarettes. I kid you not. Here are some of the potential signs you might want to watch for. Do you look at Facebook excessively? Do you get jittery when you can't check your page? Does social media interfere with your work or relationships? Then, yes, you could be addicted. Now, here's some other troubling findings from the University of Chicago's research. Excessive Facebook use can be a contributing factor in divorce. And if you're already divorced, seeing your ex on Facebook could restrict your personal growth and your emotional recovery. How about this one? Passively scrolling through your news feed can increase feelings of loneliness and isolation. And spending too much time on Facebook can lead to unhappiness with your own life. Why is that? Well, because many of your Facebook friends are putting their best foot forward and painting an unrealistically positive picture of their own lives. You know, I've mentioned before my concerns about social media, certainly excessive social media use in the past. And one of the reasons that I am concerned is that it can lead to what we might call pseudo-intimacy. You think you are close to somebody and you have hundreds of Facebook friends, but you're not really engaged in the authentic relationships that God would intend you to have. What does Peter say? Love one another deeply from the heart. I don't think it's possible to love hundreds of Facebook friends deeply. I think it's possible maybe to love a dozen people deeply. Certainly we're called to love everybody deeply, but in our relationships, are we sacrificing true intimacy for this pseudo-intimacy? Philippians 4:8, Paul says, "Fix your thoughts on what is true and honorable and right and pure and lovely and admirable. Think about things that are excellent and worthy of praise." And, you know, if Facebook ain't doing that for you, perhaps it's time to cut back. Or perhaps it's time to pull the plug altogether and just delete your account. I know that sounds really harsh to some people, but I thought this research is just, it's a real wake-up call, and I'm seeing more and more of this. Our tendency to just really get addicted to social media and electronic mobile technology, I think it could interfere with our walk with Christ, our spiritual growth, certainly with true community. Maybe I'll ask our guest about that here in a few minutes. So something to bear in mind. You can find this particular research. University of Chicago put it out, and Huffington Post has an interesting story on it this week. Well, we do get emails here at Faith Radio, and if you have a question for us about marriage or parenting or family relationships, child development, Christianity, and culture, I'd love to hear from you. Received this note from Becky in Madison, Wisconsin, and she writes, "Dear Dr. Bill, I'm concerned about my two sons. I have an angry husband who had an angry father, and he had an angry father, my husband's grandfather. I'm now seeing these tendencies in our sons. What should I do?" Wow. Well, Becky, the best way to help your sons with their anger problem is for your husband to get help for his anger problem. Kids learn to deal with life and relationships mainly from their parents. And, well, your husband's angry because he had an angry father, and now he's passing that pattern on to your sons. The Bible calls that generational sin. Your husband, through really no fault of his own, was sinned against by his angry father, and that, in turn, has caused him to sin against you and your sons by raging against you. And your family needs to break that pattern, and the responsibility rests on your husband. And I would encourage you to approach him in love when he's not angry. Tell him you're concerned about the behavior you're seeing in your sons, and ask him to consider if it could be possible that they are learning the angry responses from him. Now, I would pray that he has the ability to step back, take a look at his own actions, take responsibility for his behavior, and then make some changes. And if that's the case, that's great news. Then find a good therapist who has some experience in dealing with anger management. He should see that person. And then eventually the entire family should be involved in the counseling process, because you want to learn more effective ways to communicate with each other to resolve conflict. Obviously, it ain't working. Now, if your husband is unwilling to acknowledge that he has a problem and he responds with defensiveness or simply with more anger, then you need to seek some help from close friends, from relatives, from your church, from a pastor. You also might want to consider reading Dr. James Dobson's book, Love Must Be Tough. It'll teach you the steps that you may need to take to help your husband, to help your kids, and to help yourself. So, Becky, I'll be praying for you. Thank you so much for writing and for your vulnerability and sharing what's going on there. And again, if you'd like to email us, just go to our Faith Radio page, myfaithradio.com. Look for my program page, and we've got a contact link there. We'd love to hear from you this week. Well, it's 12 past the hour. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about the slow church. Why does the church need to slow down in America and change its whole approach to church growth? We will talk to an expert on that who's co-authored a great new book called Slow Church, Cultivating Community in the Patient Way of Jesus. That's coming up next here on the Faith Radio Network.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
Want to say hello to our great friends listening in Fargo-Moorhead on Faith 1200. Perhaps you're tuned in on Faith 1270 in Sioux Falls, South Dakota today. Thanks for joining us. Maybe you're listening in Waterloo, Iowa on Faith 1090, in Madison, Wisconsin on Faith 1190, or on the shores of beautiful Lake Superior at Faith 90.5 in Duluth. We appreciate you tuning in today, and of course to all of our friends here in the Twin Cities and beyond who have tuned in on Faith 900, our flagship station. Thanks for taking us with you today. My guest this hour is Christopher Smith. Chris is the editor of the Inglewood Review of Books and a member of the Inglewood Christian Church Community. That's in the urban east side of Indianapolis, Indiana. Chris's recent work has appeared in Books and Culture, Sojourners, The Christian Century, and Indiana Green Living. And he joins us today to talk about a new book that he has co-authored with John Pattison. It's called Slow Church, Cultivating Community in the Patient Way of Jesus. And Chris, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
It's wonderful to have you on Faith Radio this weekend. As we get started, can you tell us a little bit about the Inglewood Christian community, its history, and what it's all about?
Sure, yeah. We're a church here on the Near East Side of Indianapolis. We've been pretty much in the same location for 118 years.
Wow.
Kind of gone up and down with the neighborhood over that history. For probably the first half of that, we were a neighborhood church. And then through the 1960s, kind of the size of the congregation boomed until we got about as big as about 3,000 members. But then in the mid-70s, as the neighborhood started to pick up speed in going downhill, the size of the congregation plummeted for about a decade. And then kind of at the end of that sort of, when we kind of bottomed out in size as a congregation at about 100 people, the leaders were faced with a decision, like many urban churches: do we stay here in the neighborhood or do we move out to the suburbs where a lot of our members are at that time? And they decided that it was pretty important that we stay in the neighborhood. And kind of our journey since then has been one of trying to figure out what it means to be here, since we intentionally decided to be here. And that's kind of what Slow Church is largely about, is kind of reflection on our journey, and particularly the what it means to be a church in a place.
Can you describe for our listeners what the neighborhood is like if I was to travel around the few
sure.
square miles around your Inglewood Christian Church? What's it look like? Who lives there? And just kind of describe it for us.
Sure, yeah, definitely. It's a pretty typical urban neighborhood. We have a lot of the challenges that urban neighborhoods have. Crime, fortunately, in our neighborhood, there's not a lot of violent crime, but a lot of theft and drug activity, a lot of abandoned properties. Our neighborhood has one of the highest rates of abandoned housing in the state of Indiana, and toward the top in neighborhoods across the country. Pretty low-income neighborhood, low education. Probably, I think somebody I heard recently, 50% of the people in our neighborhood, only 50% of the people in our neighborhood have graduated from high school.
Mm.
It's probably maybe two-thirds white demographically, and probably maybe about 20% Spanish-speaking and 10% African-American, something like that. It's just kind of the ethnic demographics.
And what has the church done since it made that decision to stay? And first of all, I commend you for that, because as you mentioned, many, many churches have, you know, throughout the years, 70s and 80s was probably the time when neighborhoods often started to change and churches, the suburbs
yep,
were growing.
Particularly in urban areas.
Yeah, and the suburbs were growing, and that's where the population and the upper middle class people were, and that's where the church has moved to. And I'm thinking of the church that I actually attended for many years, Lake Avenue Church in Pasadena, California, made mm-hmm. that decision as well. They were right there in a neighborhood that was changing, and there were people in that leadership in that congregation that said, "Let's get out to those nice suburbs where it's safe and, you know, everything's pleasant." And the church leaders, to their credit, said, "No, we're going to stay here." And now
yep.
they have a great outreach to the community, and they have a Spanish-speaking congregation, a Korean-speaking congregation, and
mm-hmm.
lots of
yep.
wonderful – they've got an after-school program. And I'm guessing that your church is doing some things to really try to make a difference in that community. So describe
sure.
maybe what some of the programs are that you have
Sure, absolutely. So, I mean, just a little bit – to continue the history a little bit, I mean – one of the first things that we did that we kind of tried for about a decade from the mid-'80s to the mid-'90s was doing kind of a lot of the sort of typical things that urban churches do, and that's primarily pantry ministries, food pantry, clothing pantry, furniture pantry. And we did that for about a decade and gave away a lot of stuff to our neighbors. But we really found after doing it for that many years that we weren't really building relationships with our neighbors. We were kind of giving them stuff and sending them on their way. So what we did then was we eventually wound those ministries down and started doing community development work, fixing up houses. Like I said, there was and still is quite a bit of abandoned housing in our neighborhood, so we were able to get housing for pretty cheap and fix it up to provide affordable housing both to people in our congregation and to other neighbors as well. And also kind of about the same time that we were winding down some of the sort of pantry ministries that we did, we also started a daycare, which initially was largely for people who lived in our neighborhood, for single moms that were going back to work. That was kind of the 90s of the welfare to work programs. As women were single, parents were being encouraged to go back to work. They needed to have childcare in order to be able to do that. And we thought that that would be a good opportunity for us. We had, because our church had been so large at one time, we had plenty of space in our building to be able to do both daycare and then also to be able to house some of the offices for some of the community development work that we were doing. We've had a lot of opportunities to work with our neighbors to help this neighborhood start to flourish a little bit, or at least move in the direction of flourishing. And it's been pretty exciting to be a part of that process.
How did you get involved, Chris? Are you from that area? Did your parents grow up in that church, or did you come in from the calling?
I came here about 11 years ago. I was part of another church here in Indianapolis, actually a church that I had helped to start about 7 or 8 years before that, right as I came out of college. And basically that church, it's kind of a long story, but that church was encouraging their members to be more engaged in their neighborhoods. And right about that time, we found out that we were living right down the street from Englewood. And basically were sent out from that other church to become a part of Englewood. Since they were we were in closer proximity to Englewood than we were to the other church that we were part of at the time, the church building, that is. So it seemed like a really good thing for us to be kind of sent out from the one church to Englewood. And then probably within a year of coming to Englewood, we had an opportunity to buy a house that's just right across the parking lot from the church building. And the block that we live on that's right behind the church building probably has about 15 households that have our people from the church. So probably at least 50 people from the congregation live on our block.
How many of those are from that original church that had the sending out program? Did you have a kind of a core group that said, let's go over and help them?
There was our family, and there was a couple other single people that came to the church, came to Englewood when we did. Unfortunately, our family is the only one that is still part of our congregation, but there were others that came with us. The home group that we were a part of as part of the other church basically dissolved, and we went. Some of us went to Englewood, those of us that lived on this part of town, and other ones went to other home groups within the other church that were closer to where they were living. So basically just dissolved the home group that we had.
Now, do you have children?
Yes, I do. I have three children who are 9, 11, and 11. They're pretty active in our church here.
One of the things that parents in your situation often have to struggle with or ask themselves this question. And fortunately, you said there's not a lot of crime in your neighborhood, but I've certainly talked to people involved in programs like yours, where a church goes into an urban community and they're in dangerous places where there's constant crime. And so as a mom and dad, you have to ask yourself, okay, is this a safe place for my kids? Of course, balancing that with this is a great opportunity for my kids to learn how to serve and to learn what it means to care for those who are underprivileged. So how have you and your wife balanced that out, or was it ever even a question for you?
I mean, it wasn't really a question. We know the neighborhood well enough, and a lot of the crime that does go on in our neighborhood, there is crime significant amount of crime in our neighborhood, not violent crime, fortunately, but most of it tends to go on in the hours between midnight and 4 a.m. or so. And typically, I mean, we don't wander the streets during that part of the night. I mean, it's just, I mean, common sense sort of things. And I mean, always not encouraging our kids. I mean, our kids are still fairly young, but not encouraging them to kind of wander the neighborhood by themselves.
Right. So they're not out taking bike rides for miles around the church property.
No, definitely not. But the good thing about kind of the nature of our church community as it is that there are a number of other kids around, and they play. We have a playground that they can play on and in the church parking lot, and they can be pretty close where we can keep an eye on them, and they can also be with other kids that can keep an eye on things. So yeah, I mean, I don't think that – I mean, there are certainly are things that go on here, but we've been pretty fortunate, and we try not to do things that would make us or our children particularly vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've taken your experience and what your church has done, and a lot of it is really in this book, Slow Church. Uh-huh. We're going to unpack the book here in just a bit, and tell me about, we've just got about 2 minutes before the break, tell me about your co-author, John Pattison.
So John lives in a small rural town in Oregon, about 45 minutes or an hour outside of Portland, and is part of a Quaker, an evangelical Quaker congregation there in that small town, and they're on a similar journey. Englewood probably has been on the journey a little bit longer, but they're definitely taking very seriously the things that their church is taking very seriously, the things that we're writing about in the Slow Church book as well, and seeking to be a deeper church community together.
Interesting. How'd the two of you meet?
We were both my day job, if you will, is I'm the editor of a magazine that we do here at Englewood called the Englewood Review of Books. And John was also writing about books. He was the books editor for Relevant magazine for a while.
Okay.
And we met because we were both writing about books. I wrote some reviews for him, and he wrote some reviews for me. And it was actually him, he that had the idea to do the Slow Church book. And because we kind of had this friendship around books, and he kind of got to know our church congregation, he's like, oh, you guys are kind of doing some of the things that I'm thinking about. So that was kind of how we got together to write the books.
So you have one author from a very urban area, one from a more rural area, both trying to do the same sort of thing in their community. And we're going to unpack what Chris and John are doing and what they recommend for churches in the in 2014, as we continue on the Faith Radio Network. By the way, we have three copies of Chris's book to give away. If you call us and give us your contact info, we'd love to hear from you. 877-93-FAITH is the number. Give us your name, address, phone number, email. And at the end of the hour, we'll have a drawing for three copies of Slow Church, Cultivating Community in the Patient Way of Jesus. Take a quick break and be right back with more with Chris Smith. Stick with us.
Continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
Welcome back. We're talking to Chris Smith, one of the co-authors of Slow Church, Cultivating Community in the Patient Way of Jesus. Here's what Scott McKnight says about the book. One of the freshest alternatives to church life as it is today. Buy this, but don't read it fast. Read it slow. Nice praise there, huh, Chris?
Yeah. Thought that was pretty witty.
That's great. Well, now, let's talk about the title for a minute, because it really springs from the whole slow food movement, which I guess started, I don't know, 20 years ago or so.
25 years ago. Actually, yeah this is the December will be the 25th anniversary of the kind of manifesto that started the slow food movement.
What was slow food, and is it still something that's vital today? And how does it then? How do you apply church growth and church decisions to this whole slow food movement? It's kind of an interesting parallel.
Sure, sure, yeah. So the slow food movement is an international movement that started, like I said, about 25 years ago, kind of in reaction to both. Fast food, but also kind of the larger ways in which the fast food mentality was shaping culture. The slow food movement focused on, one, eating good food, and two, enjoying the time around the table, the sort of culture that's created around the table as families and friends eat together and share time around the table together. So slow food very much has a very strong emphasis on local community. There's a preference in the slow food movement for local food where there's a sort of bond that's built between the farmers that grow the food and the consumers that buy the food from the farmers. There's a focus on the sorts of community that are nurtured around the table as people take their time and eat together, eat good food, good healthy food together. So that's the slow food movement. It's, like I said, it's grown into an international movement, still very much alive and well. There's a lot of things that have kind of come through a slow food movement, kind of the revitalization of the farmers market movement has come as a result of the work of slow food, a lot of the emphasis on local and organic foods has kind of come through the efforts of the slow food movement. So what does all that have to do with church? John and I, again, were realizing the ways in which, just like the slow food movement saw the ways in which fast food had kind of given shape to the culture around it and really made people more impatient, more increased the expectation for speed and efficiency. We also saw the ways in which that sort of mentality of fast life had seeped into our churches and the ways in which churches are becoming, in a lot of cases, not so much communities anymore, but just places where we as individual Christians come and are spiritually filled, and then we go on our way. But churches are, in a lot of instances, are not really communities anymore. And also the ways in which the gospel has been reduced over the years, over the last 50 or 30 years, reducing the gospel to four easy steps or reducing the gospel to a particular political ideology. All those things we think are kind of a product of a mentality that prefers speed and prefers efficiency. And we think they're all interconnected and all detrimental to what God intends for the people of God to be.
Well, that was a great description, and let's now look at the average church in America. And you mentioned a moment ago, unfortunately, so many churches have become these places where people go to get spiritually fed and then go on their merry way. And I would even say there are some churches where people go to get entertained. And then such an emphasis on putting on a show. And I personally, and I'm sure we have some listeners who would disagree with me on this, but I personally rebel when I visit a new church. Let's say I'm traveling and I go to a church that's been recommended, maybe a mega church or even not a mega church. Maybe it's a medium sized church. And I go in, and what I experience during worship is lights and sound and multimedia and choreography. And I'm sorry, Chris, it just leaves me feeling kind of empty. Maybe that's just me. But I do get concerned when we spend so much time and energy trying to put on a good show to make people feel good or attract new people in the door, and often so little time on things like discipleship and growing true community, service, imitating Jesus.
Absolutely. Those intuitions are exactly what was plaguing us and kind of drove us to write the book. If there's something that we're opposed to, primarily, it is the church growth movement. We're not opposed to churches growing, but there is this thing called the church growth movement that started probably in about the 1960s. And actually, the pastor that we had at Englewood, when we really ballooned in size as a congregation, was very interested in the church growth movement, which is basically these techniques for growing a large congregation, the main one of which is what's known as the homogeneous unit principle. And that basically all that says is that you can grow a congregation really large if you focus on a very narrow segment, a demographic segment. So if you focus on suburban upper middle class people, for instance, and a lot of church growth churches do that, because you're focusing on such a narrow demographic and you can grow a congregation pretty large, but what you lose in the process is the sort of diversity and the sort of reconciliation that happens or can happen when different people of different races, ethnicities, economic backgrounds, when they come together and work together as part of a single congregation. I think that also along with the church growth movement comes a lot of the things that you described, sort of the reduction of church to entertainment, the really heavy emphasis on kind of the pastor as CEO or the pastor as key entertainer, ringmaster, if you will, almost. You don't want to turn the book, but all of those are sorts of shortcuts to the sort of community life. That's one of the things that we point out in the book, and I think that it's something that it's really easy for us to miss. But if you look at Scripture, it seems to us that in looking at Scripture, what God is doing in the world is one of the main things that God is doing in the world is gathering a people. And this is something that began in Israel, of course, with the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but then continued in the church. I mean, one of the first things that Jesus did when he came of age and started to practice his ministry was he gathered a community of disciples around him. It's not insignificant that there were 12 disciples, which some theologians think actually points to the 12 tribes of Israel, that what Jesus was doing was not something apart from Israel, but it was definitely something very much in line with what God had been doing in Israel. And then the people of God at Pentecost was the kind of wall of ethnicity was torn down, and Gentiles were welcomed into the people of God as well as Jews. And I think what we've lost in the modern age of individualism is the sense that God's gathering of people is very much at the center of the gospel of what God is doing in the world. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're trying to recover in this book. Obviously, the subtitle kind of alludes to that, of cultivating community in the patient way of Jesus.
Now, one of the struggles that we face today in our society that Jesus, of course, did not face is we have a very mobile society where often people relocate for work. And Indianapolis being a big city, I'm sure you've seen people come and go. You mentioned that of that original core group, very few of those families, you're the only family that remains from the original core group. How do you balance the fact that we are in a mobile society and that people do get transferred and have to make moves? Do we need to say, okay, what's our priority here? Is our priority to stay and serve and be part of this community, or is our priority to achieve and advance and take new opportunities, even though that might mean a move? I mean, that's kind of a balancing act that every Christian faces.
Absolutely. I think those are the key questions. I think you've hit the nail on the head right there. And, I mean, for many of us here at Englewood, we really do see as our primary identity in the church community. And then from that primary identity, we're able to sort out vocation and the sorts of work that we do, which has led us to start a number of businesses around community development, around our daycare, that give people an opportunity to actually do work that is kind of in line with the mission and identity that we have together as the church. But again, I mean, not everybody's ready for that. But we do. I mean, I think that's the direction that we really try to encourage people to do, to really think before to think and talk. Probably if there's one kind of practice that kind of underlies the whole book, it's the practice of conversation. So much of we've been so conditioned by kind of the nature of Western culture to not talk with one another, not talk with our neighbors, not talk with other people in our congregation. We just want to live our lives and do our own thing. And I don't think that's healthy. I don't think that's what God intends. I think that the thing that we would encourage more than kind of developing a new sort of legalism around, oh, you have to stay put. we'd rather encourage people to talk with people when they have an opportunity to move to a different place, talk with your church about it and discern together if that a good thing and what will some of the consequences of that move be for the life of the church. But also it's very important too. We do really encourage individuals and families to at least consider staying put. But we also think maybe it's even more important that churches stay put. You heard that a little bit when I told Englewood story. But there is great damage that's done, and we've seen this all in our urban neighborhood and a lot of other urban neighborhoods in Indianapolis and other cities around the country, that when a church moves out of a neighborhood, there's a vacuum that's left. We may not realize it, but there is, I mean, that we churches play roles in their neighborhoods, and when we decide to move to another place, we may be doing some significant damage, particularly in the sort of witness that we bear to our neighbors. So I think that's perhaps maybe even more important as far as staying put, that our churches of course, the question comes up about what if we outgrow the space that we have, and I tell a story in the book of the church that I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, that kind of faced that situation themselves of kind of maxing out their facilities, and what they decided to do was to plant new churches, find that they looked at where their members were and found out where there were pockets of a number of families kind of living together, kind of on a little bit of the perimeter, of the outskirts of where their membership lived, and they kind of empowered those groups to start their own churches, and they probably started maybe half a dozen churches that way, kind of throughout the D.C. metropolitan area, and I've always kind of been struck by that as a way. The kind of mother church didn't move, but instead they sent people out, and I've always thought that was kind of a fascinating way to deal with the problem of kind of maxing out the capacity of the space.
It is interesting to just look at the history over the last, especially 30, 40, 50 years of how many major downtown churches that were thriving moved away and left that vacuum, and oftentimes left a, you know, dilapidated, you know, decrepit building falling apart, or maybe some other church came in and used it and tried to make the best of it. But yeah, that certainly has been a an artifact of what's happened to just our culture over the years. And it's a great encouragement for us to stay put and to serve and to grow right where God has planted us, and probably most importantly, to do the ministry that he would have us do to our friends and neighbors in that community. We're talking to Chris Smith, and he is one of the co-authors of the new book, Slow Church, Cultivating Community in the Patient Way of Jesus. We actually have three copies of the book to give away, And if you call us in the next 10 minutes or so and give us your contact info, we will put you into a drawing for a copy of one of those books. Maybe you are challenged by what Chris has been saying, and you're saying, you know, I'd like to take this to my church leaders, and we're grappling with some of these same things and like to learn from what Chris and his co-author John Pattison have to say. Call us at 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH, and give us your contact info. It's 1147. I'm Bill Meyer. You are listening to the Faith Radio Network. We're going to take a quick break and be back with one more segment with Christopher Smith, author of Slow Church, after this on the Faith Radio Network.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And thanks for joining us today on this Saturday in the Upper Midwest. We're talking to Chris Smith, co-author of Slow Church, Cultivating Community in the Patient Way of Jesus. Very challenging book. It will maybe turn your church growth strategy upside down. Maybe that's a good thing. Chris, one of the chapters in your book is called Patience, and you talk about the early church and how the early church had to learn to be patient and had to learn to suffer. And there is a real aversion to suffering in our society today in Western culture. In fact, I think it's a aversion to not feeling completely comfortable at all times. Can you explain what the early church can teach us about patience and suffering?
Sure. I mean, for me personally, just reading the stories of the martyrs, particularly in the early church era, but also in other eras, my mom grew up Mennonite, and there's a pretty strong tradition of in that part of the church of reading the stories of the martyrs from the early Anabaptist era in the 1600s or 16th century. Reading these stories and realizing that, people were persecuted for their faith and really faced that persecution with complete trust in the resurrection. That, even if their life was taken from them, that was even all the better because they would be in the presence of God. And really, that was kind of at the there was a sort of a fearlessness there because of the resurrection. And I think that, like you were explaining, that we see in the book, that we've lost a lot of that being willing to suffer or enter into the sufferings of others through the sort of industrialization and technology that's developed. The rise, and we talk in the book about the rise of the labor-saving device, which is wonderful. That a lot of machines really did kind of save people from kind of back-breaking sorts of labor that kind of dominated agrarian life in the pre-modern age. But today, I think we really need to ask ourselves, to what end are we saving time, saving labor? Are we just doing it so that we can indulge ourselves, to entertain ourselves just a little bit more? Because I think that, it's that sort of mindset that that avoids suffering, avoids work at all costs, that really starts to inhibit us from entering into the sufferings of others. And that's what the nature of compassion is that Jesus embodied for us. That whole Philippians 2 passage of God, Jesus not hesitating to take on the form of humanity, to enter into the world and to suffer as humans suffer. And that's the Christ that we're called to follow after. And I think that the ways in which we've kind of been formed to the industrialization of the world, the fast food world around us, has really inhibited us in significant ways in following in the way of Jesus.
I was mentioning at the beginning of the program just some new research out about social networking, about Facebook, and And I've talked about this in the program before, and I'm sure I make some people mad when I do, but I believe that mobile technology in particular is could be one of the most destructive things to our spiritual growth. And again, people will say, well, but there are so many wonderful things, and social networking can provide all these great opportunities to connect. And yes, it can. And I don't want to, you know, cast, you know, the whole thing out. But I do believe when I see so many Christians, and I saw it at my church last weekend, you know, just looking around at the number of people on their devices, and I believe it can keep us from true community. It can. I was talking about this pseudo intimacy thing, where whether you're talking about again social networking, mobile technology, just the constantly being plugged in, it certainly does not encourage us to slow down and enter into real community. I don't know if you guys have experienced that or talked about that there in your community.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that it's a tightrope. I mean, I think John and I both are pretty heavily engaged in social media, and I mean, we have a Facebook page for the book and all that. But so, I mean, again, we don't want to be legalistic and say thou shalt not. But I think you're right. I think the spirit of what you're saying is right. That, and particularly, I agree with you. I think that mobile technology is a much greater threat to the source of presence. I think one of our friends, Phil Kinnison, who's a theologian, says that, and others have said too, that the greatest thing that God has given humanity is God's very own presence, and also the greatest thing that we can give one another is our presence, our full undivided attention, and technology really interferes with that, particularly, as you said, mobile technology. And so I do think we really need to ask very hard questions and really develop some practices, commit to some things, some discipline for ourselves of okay, when I'm at home or when I'm at church, my phone's going to be off or something like that, and it's not going to distract me. Again, I mean, it's committing to things that is not kind of universal rules, but disciplines that we undertake for the health and well-being of the relationships that we have in the home and in the church particularly, but also maybe in certain neighborhood situations as well. But to start in those places and to really create some spaces that are perhaps mobile technology free, I think would be beneficial.
I think you're right on target there. And again, we don't want to be legalistic, but I think we need some guards and some guides. We've just got about a minute and a half left, Chris. I know you talk about the Sabbath and the importance of the Sabbath in your book. Can you just give us a quick summary of what you say there?
Sure, absolutely. Again, I mean, it's kind of the same sort of thing that we've just been talking about with technology, is that, I mean, we need spaces that are ceasing from work. We talk about work, and I talked about that kind of in terms of patience. That, I mean, the way of Jesus is going to require significant work of us. It's going to require blood, sweat, and tears. But the flip side of that then is Sabbath. That the work isn't the end of the story. But we need spaces in which we can kind of take a step back and just enjoy being with one another. Enjoy the gifts that God has given us. And again, that's something that's very difficult. Most times when Sabbath is talked about among Christians, it's very typically talked about as either a personal or a family sort of practice. But it's interesting that when Sabbath was instituted among the people of Israel, it was a social practice. It was a practice that defined who they were as a community, and really helped them to interact with one another as a community on a particular day, to create a space among that community in which they could share life together more intentionally and be present to one another in ways that the work days wouldn't quite allow them to do that.
Mm. Chris, we appreciate so much your time and your commitment to this labor of love in this book that you and John Pattison have written. Once again, it's called Slow Church, Cultivating Community in the Patient Way of Jesus. I pray that God will continue to use you and your fellow community members there to impact your neighborhood for Christ. And we thank you for your time today, Chris.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Bill, for having me. And God bless you.
God bless you. This is the Faith Radio Network, and we hope you have a wonderful weekend. I'll be back next Saturday at 11 a.m. can find all of our programming at myfaithradio.com. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. If you'd like more information about this show, you can visit our program page at myfaithradio.com.